And our sermon text then, today, is Psalm 73. And that begins on page 485 in your pew Bible. A psalm of Asaph. Truly, God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled, my steps had nearly slipped. For I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For they have no pangs until death, their bodies are fat and sleek. They are not in trouble as others are. They are not stricken like the rest of mankind. Therefore, pride is their necklace. Violence covers them as a garment. Their eyes swell out through fatness. Their hearts overflow with follies. They scoff and speak with malice. Loftily they threaten oppression. They set their mouths against the heavens, and their tongue struts through the earth. Therefore his people turn back to them and find no fault in them. And they say, how can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the wicked, always at ease. They increase in riches. All in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. For all the day long I have been stricken and rebuked every morning. If I had said, I will speak thus, I would have betrayed the generation of your children. But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task. Until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discerned therein. Truly, you have set them in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors. Like a dream when one awakes, O Lord, when you rouse yourself, you despise them as phantoms. When my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in heart, I was brutish and ignorant. I was like a beast toward you. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire beside you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. For behold, those who are far from you shall perish. You put an end to everyone who is unfaithful to you. But for me, it is good to be near God. I have made the Lord God my refuge, that I may tell of all your works. See why this is one of my favorite psalms? Very powerful, isn't it? Christopher Marlowe's play, The Damnable Life of Dr. Faustus, where the great Renaissance scholar Faustus sells his soul to the devil in exchange for 24 years of what he calls voluptuous knowledge. That is knowledge not only of the world and its workings, but of evil. Voluptuous in the sense that it is sensual. It's still a myth that haunts the 21st century mankind. Dr. Rollo May, psychiatrist who wrote a very insightful book called The Cry for Myth, he calls this Western myth a poignant and powerful expression of the myth of our modern age. There is no doubt the Faustian myth, he says, is all about us. It is alive, or more so today as at any time in the four centuries past, he says. The West tends to sell its soul for voluptuous knowledge. In his play, it's still very dramatic and still a page turn. So, you know, if you're homeschooling your kids, they have to read Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, The Damnable Life of Dr. Faustus. In his play, Marlowe has Dr. Faustus as an educated Renaissance scholar, dissatisfied with his limited experience. He wants to taste all there is of the budding sciences, all there is of life, and oh, by the way, be rich and have all the beautiful women too. So in the midst of waiting for the devil's messenger, Mephistopheles, to appear, Faustus muses in an excited anticipation. He can't wait to sell his soul. Oh, what a world of profit and delight, of power, of honor, and omnipotence is promised to the studious artisan. All things that move between the quiet poles shall be at my command. So when the devil's demon does appear, Faustus signs a contract for his soul in his own blood, in exchange for which he plumbs the depths of dark magical knowledge. He becomes fabulously wealthy and beds the most beautiful women in history for a period of 24 years. Dr. May calls this ubiquitous myth practiced amongst us, is it not, even today? He calls it a myth of conscience, springing from the pride, greed, lust, and despair of a man which commits him to eternal darkness, unquote. And that is his ultimate fate, by the way. As the clock strikes midnight on the day his contract has run its course, Faustus says in great terror, "It strikes! It strikes! Now, body, turn to air, or Lucifer will bear thee quick to hell. There's thunder and lightning. O soul, be changed to litter water droplets and fall into the ocean, never to be found. Devils come up from the pit." And he says, my God, look not so fierce on me. Adders and serpents, let me breathe a while. Ugly hell, gape not. Come not, Lucifer. I'll burn my books." Which, of course, to a Renaissance man, meant the end of dabbling in magic, the end of this voluptuous knowledge that he sought. That's his last words. "I'll burn my books." Oh, Mephistopheles! And he's dragged down into hell. Pretty dramatic, huh? If this myth is indeed all about us, what does it say about us? We see samples of this all through our world, do we not? We do seem to be a people who run around aspiring to every experience, regardless of consequence, grasping after riches, fame, sexual thrill. Only at the end do we sometimes have a pang of conscience when it's too late. This is May's point in calling it our myth. A myth of conscience springing from the pride, greed, lust, and despair of men that commit them to eternal darkness, it does. I submit to you the damnable life of Dr. Faustus is not only a modern myth. It seems that our psalmist encountered the very same circumstance and temptations. Let's look to our text today to see whether, like Faustus, he succumbs to it. Does Asaph succumb to the Faustian myth, or whether God intervenes in grace? Let's look to our psalm today, shall we? The inside flap of your bulletin, you have a two-point brief outline I'd like to cover with you. Two major points I'd like to make with you. First of all, perspective. This psalm is all about perspective. One that will damn your soul to hell, or one that will launch you to heaven. Seen from the vantage point of the temporal, it pays to practice wickedness and eschew righteousness, doesn't it? Verses 1 to 15. From the vantage point of the temporal exclusively, it pays to practice wickedness, to shunt aside righteousness, huh? Verses 1 to 15. Psalm 73 begins the third book of five that constitutes the Songbook of Israel. Always, always remember, keep in mind that this psalm was sung in the worship of Israel. This is one that could be easily adapted to the individual who may have had some of the same experience, the same temptations, the Faustian myth to succumb to. It is classified as a wisdom psalm since it considers both the fool and the wise, the Nabal and the Chochmah in the Hebrew, and their respective behaviors and their respective destinies too. It's a popular theme of wisdom literature. Our Old Testament text we read today from Job is much along the same lines. Asaph composed this psalm, being a son of Levi. He was the first choir master of Israel whose sons carried on his tradition and his gifts. Asaph had a reputation for wisdom too, no doubt in part for this rendition of a most excellent piece of wisdom. Asaph begins with a confession of praise. This is the thematic verse. These motifs will be rung throughout the psalm. Truly God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. Which might have continued on in this vein for the rest of the psalm. It's a marvelous theme throughout the psalms, isn't it? The Psalter represented psalms of narrative praise, psalms of personal praise. But what makes it a wisdom psalm is we're brought up short, this skeptical direction into which we are suddenly wrenched, where we wrestle with issues that fly in the face of the rosy characterization first rung as a bell of optimism in God, right? Our thematic chain is yanked, figuratively, by this adversative but. It's very significant. The sense is, while it's perfectly established that X, Y, Z, and others live profitably in this truth, in my case, that's emphatic here, in my case, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped. Just as Dr. Faustus slipped and stumbled into gaping hell, dragged down by demons, so Asaph tottered on that edge, almost stumbling, almost slipping. His heart for this interlude, at least, was not pure, suffused, as he says, with envy. I was envious of the wicked. What an exceptional experience. Nobody is ever envious of the wicked, are they, in real life? How many souls have this green-eyed envy? And how many souls has green-eyed envy dragged down to hell in the history of man? Dante has hell peopled with in hell who have been dragged down by envy. So it prompts such evil deeds, envy does, doesn't it, in order to be assuaged? And Asaph is bothered by eight features of these evil who prosper. Let me list them for you, and you will see these reflected in evil people in your own life, perhaps, or evil people that we see in our culture before us. If your eyes are open, if you are awake to these things, we have just as much evil before us, if not more, today than Asaph did in his day. Eight features of those who prosper. First of all, verse number 4, they have no pangs unto death. Their bodies are fat and sleek. They are as fat and well-fed as Jabba the Hutt. The evil. The pangs absent are hunger pangs. We often say, oh, I'm starving. Yeah, well, you're pricked a little bit in your stomach. You're maybe a little bit hungry, but you're not starving. In the ancient days, with the waxing and waning of the food supply, hunger pangs were real. Always coming to mind, of course, with this fat and sleek, was a metaphor in that day for how well you provided for your family. If you were a good provider for your family, you had a fat wife, not a sleek and trim and fit wife. That was the mark of prosperity in those days. But it always brings to mind, of course, for me, and that I see that resonates with you too, Jabba the Hutt, right? Popping frogs into his mouth like bonbons. Ooh. Perfect metaphor for the glutton he is. They, the wicked, are fat and well-fed as Jabba the Hutt. Secondly, verse 5. They are not in trouble as others are. They're not stricken like the rest of mankind, verse 5. That is, they are able to buy their way out of trouble. George Soros never has trouble paying his mortgage. Wall Street bankers never have trouble paying their health insurance. My very first congregation I served was a wealthy congregation in Lake Forest. Numbers of times I had to come and sit and hold the hands of parents whose kids were in the huskah, in jail. Keep this quiet, okay, Pastor? Keep this quiet. And they could keep it quiet. They could buy his bail, buy him a fancy lawyer, and pretty soon the kid was out of trouble. Disgusting. They are able to buy their way out of trouble. Number three, verse 6. Therefore, pride is their necklace. Violence covers them as a garment. Ferguson, Missouri, are you listening? New York City, are you listening? Pride, a necklace. Violence, a cover. In other words, for the wicked, their consequent overweening pride breeds violence as an easy solution to resistance of their will. For the wicked, their overweening pride breeds violence as you come to scoff and scorn other life, especially life below you, as an easy solution to resistance of their will. The rich and the power, make no mistake about this, have utter contempt for you. It was true under Ahab and Jezebel in Israel, and it's true in the good old US of A as well. The militarization of our police force is a foretaste of what is to come. Ferguson, New York City, huh? Test cases. They are the beginning of sorrows, if you will, as John would put it. Well, the evil then in verse 7. What are the wicked like in verse 7? Their eyes swell out through their fatness. Jabba the Hutt again, right? Their eyes swell out through fatness. Their hearts overflow with follies. That is, they greedily sate every lust and desire that arises. As you become more and more debauched in your morals and in your lifestyle, this is the state of life. The greedy Satan. The greedy sating of every lust and desire that arises. In our own culture, we are entertained to death as it is. Every lust, desire, and appetite is indulged to its full, as fully as we can afford. The rich can afford very much. Number five. In verse 8, they scoff and speak with malice. Loftily, they threaten oppression. That is, they despitefully use and oppress the little people. Make no mistake, the rich and the powerful once again see you as expendable pawns on a chessboard of their own making. But, Pastor, the rich and the powerful, they love me. They tell me they do. We'll feed you government cheese. The hallmark, right, of government food, government cheese. But, Pastor, the rich and the powerful, they love me. We'll give you all, they want to house me and shelter me. Government housing. Go to Cabrini Green in Chicago and see what you get with government housing. But, Pastor, my government, the people, the rich and the powerful, they love me. They want to give me health care. Yeah, the hallmark of government health care recently, the Veterans Administration, death lists. The rich and the powerful, they love you. Don't be fooled. They despitefully use and oppress, and when they're done with you, they get rid of you. Number six, verse 9. They set their mouths against the heavens, and their tongue struts through the earth. That is, they swagger as gods of heaven and earth. Indeed, lay claim to heaven and earth. They swagger as gods of heaven and earth, the wicked. And as is every son of Adam, so the rich and the powerful aspire to be gods, right? Satan promised them that you will be as gods, knowing good and evil. The rich swagger as gods of heaven and earth. Number 7, then verse 10. Therefore his people turn back to them and find no fault in them. Wake up, the spineless ones. Might makes right. The bulk of humanity acquiesce to this tour de force, do they not? And that is the case. We see it before our eyes. The bulk of humanity acquiesce to this tour de force. That, in effect, makes might right. For the wicked, their motto is the golden rule. Those were the gold rule. And the people like it just fine. That is the case with most. And then finally, verse 11, which reads, and they say, how can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? Look at the arrogance, dripping with arrogance here. That is, they arrogantly consider themselves as unaccountable to the God of heaven and earth. This bothers Asaph about the wicked as well. They seem to get away with everything. God didn't strike them down. After all, the first time they stole bubblegum, pulled the wings off flies, or punched their little sister, and they've just been going at it ever since. So, these realities, and I submit to you, they are realities, just as real today as they were then, if not more so, have a devastating impact on Asaph, as they do to so many of us. You'll find a lot of awake and frustrated people out there for whom these kinds of realities about the wicked drive to consternation. They don't sell their souls. And oftentimes drive us to irrational, sinful behavior as well. That doesn't mean we are to be inactive, but we must be cautious and be wise too. This calls for biblical wisdom. Asaph says, all of my righteousness, my aspiration to live a pure and obedient life is for nothing, doesn't he, in verse 13. All in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. That's a great figure of speech, isn't it? In Israel, washing my hands in innocence rather than washing it in blood. Secondly, it bothers Asaph. He says, this is obvious when one compares my troubled life with the life of ease of the wicked, in verse 14. For all the day long, I have been stricken and rebuked every morning. Not so these guys. They get away with everything. Thirdly, he's bothered by what could have transpired with the youth, right? With kids, with the generation upcoming. Better to have a millstone hung around your neck and thrown in the ocean than to make one of these little ones stumble. He says, my silence on this issue, so destructive to those around me, is about to make me explode. If I had said, I will speak thus, that is, as I've been speaking, I would have betrayed the generation of your children. Maybe cause some of them to stumble. Maybe cause some of them to sell their soul, a la Dr. Faustus. Well, shall we end there and continue next week? Because this is not all, is it? If this was all, you might feel ready to sell your soul to Mephistopheles. Got a few years left, I might as well spend it like the wicked, huh? Well, fortunately, it does not end there. And there is point two, verses 16 to 28. Perspective. This is a psalm of perspective. How you behave, how you live, how you think, your eternal destiny depends on this perspective. Verses 16 to 28, perspective. Seen from the vantage point of eternity, it pays to cling to Yahweh and eschew wickedness. Once again, this little adversative but, right, changes our course, yanks our chain back the other way. But when I thought to how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task, comma, punctuation is very important, is it not? You can say, it's time to eat, Grandma. Or it's time to eat, Grandma. It was wearisome, seemed wearisome to me, comma, until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I discerned their end. Here, wisdom comes upon him in a flood. This is a wisdom psalm. Note the keys here. His thought, his understanding, his task. These things are discerned. This is all wisdom language. What is the crucial turning point for Asaph in his thinking here? profoundly revealing. Until I went into the sanctuary of God. Until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then he gets perspective. In 1915, Dr. Alfred Wegener published The Origins of Continents and Oceans, in which he postulated that what we now know as separate and distinct continents were at one time one large landmass. His big idea led to the development of the science of plate tectonics, which theorizes that the surface of the Earth is composed of large plates, which are not static, but which move and shift over the surface of the Earth, subject to forces like subduction, uplift, volcanic activity deep within the core of the Earth. And over millions of years, these plates move over the surface of the Earth like giant mobile puzzle pieces. Well, tell me something I don't know already, Pastor, right? Because geology has demonstrated these facts, accounting for things like earthquakes and volcanoes, even the wonders of Yellowstone, which, don't hold your breath, but could go at any moment. Yellowstone sits on a huge bubbling cauldron of molten lava called a caldera. Now, this idea of plate tectonics was scoffed at for decades until the development of seismology, which allowed scientists to track the movements of the Earth's surface composed of these plates, a science now called plate tectonics. This big idea now accounts for other smaller activities, for volcanic activity around the globe, like the Hawaiian Islands, still bubbling underneath a cauldron themselves. Earthquake activity, plate tectonics accounts for as well. San Francisco sits on the San Andreas Fault, for example. Also accounts for how fossils from ancient seabeds can be found in the mountains of Patagonia, too. Well, before this big idea, men experienced all of these phenomena, but they experienced them in isolation and without a comprehensive explanation. But now, having mapped these tectonic plates from both under the sea and from space satellites, we have the perspective to see the whole, the big idea, and how it all fits together in a comprehensive global picture. Well, Asaph, until he went into the temple precincts, had the same view of the isolated incidences, individual wicked men, and their experiences and their apparent destinies, until he went into the temple precincts. Our word there is sanctuary, but it literally means, it's plural, it means holy places. And it was a metaphor in Hebrew for the complex of temple spaces. So he's actually talking about moving through the entire temple and all of its spaces and precincts. And until then, he had only experienced these phenomena of life in isolation, a fat, sleek Jabba the Hutt here, a wealthy, wicked man like George Soros there, a powerful, corrupt politician like Obama as he stands in his own historical moment, all these individual, isolated incidences. And given these narrow, myopic perspectives, he could only conclude that this is wisdom. This is the course of life. Practice wickedness. Pure self-interest. Suck the marrow out of life while you can. No one sees. God holds no man accountable. This is all the natural man can see, however, isn't it? This is all the natural man can see. Because he has not been birthed again with eyes to see and ears to hear. Figuratively, if you will, trapped on Maui, he can't see the satellite view of the Hawaiian Islands as a series, formed as its plate moves under the volcanic hotspot over millions of years, spewing matter up from the sea floor to form yet another island. That takes perspective. Once again, so entering the sanctuary, a metaphor here for understanding the will of God in redemptive history. This is true biblical wisdom. He sees this as he circulates among the temple precincts, doesn't he, and spends time there and his soul and heart are transformed. But now, in the sanctuary, Asaph is, if you will, shot upwards to the satellite view of all things, seeing in God's revealed word where Jabba the Hutt, George Soros, and Barack Obama fit in the whole plan of God, and precisely what is their ultimate fate too. Then and only then was Asaph able to discern their end, as he says. Well, then, what certain truth was he able to see here that he wasn't able to see before? Four things. Number one, from the perspective of eternity, the wicked step on banana peels. Truly, you set them in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. That's the sense here of verse 18. Truly a text of icy footing, spiritually speaking, indeed. Ice. We have lots of ice in our place. I wasn't sure whether we were going to get out of our driveway without a broken bone up where we are. How fast can you go down when you slip on the ice, huh? Before you know it. The analogy holds true for the wicked here in terms of their life and eternity. This life may seem like an eternity sometime, especially when you bear the problems of the world, but when you get the perspective of heaven, you realize it's very fast. Secondly, in verse 19, he says, how they are destroyed in a moment, swept away by utter terrors, utterly by terrors. From the perspective of eternity, Asaph sees now the wicked stand in an arroyo, if you will. Flash floods descend in these narrow, dry canyons in the desert, and they come up awfully suddenly as well. Would you build your house in an arroyo? In an arroyo? You'd be a fool to do so. Jesus uses this very picture in his parable on the strong and the weak foundations. So, from the perspective of heaven and eternity, the wicked stand in an arroyo. Thirdly, then in verse 20, he learns, like a dream when one awakes, O Lord, when you rouse yourself, you despise them as phantoms. From the perspective of eternity, the wicked are pale shades of Morpheus. My wife, the other day, she said she was so tired she was going to sink into the arms of Morpheus. I use that phrase a lot too, but who's Morpheus? Wait a minute. Oh yeah. He's the god of sleep, of course, from Greek. The Greeks had a lively notion of sleep as a world. When experienced under its power, as real and tangible, the world of sleep. Only when one awoke did he look back and see it as Asaph characterizes it, that is, as a dream. Figures are phantoms. You ever had dreams like that, which are so real you wake up? I was shaking Debbie one morning. I had a dream that seemed so real to me. But when you awake, you realize, you keep this in perspective. It's a world of phantoms. So it is with the life of the wicked. Fourthly then, verses 21 and 22. When my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in heart, I was brutish and ignorant, I was like a beast towards you. From the perspective of eternity, this kind of envious, sinful behavior makes me bestial. Saw that in the psalm that we read this morning too, to commence worship. So, while my passions as well, I share them with the wicked, to have what the wicked have. While they indeed are real and immediate and human, they are, in the light of heaven, the passions of beasts and animals. Keep that in mind. For the wicked, when they degenerate and decay and debauch, they begin to live and behave as animals. And it's not a proper topic to deal with here on Sunday morning in the sermons, but indeed, they do. Animals don't delay their gratification, do they? When an appetite seizes them, they satisfy it immediately. So it is with the wicked. So, conversely then, this same perspective. An Old Testament saint drawing near to God, isn't he? He finds his way to the sanctuary, to the temple. Don't glide over that too quickly. The Old Testament saint, the Israelite, would know what that means. To go to the sanctuary. It was more than just, you know, posting your name up there and throwing your 10% in the coffers and walking away. For him, dwelling with God was dwelling with him in his sanctuary, smelling the odor of incense and burning sacrifices as he makes his way up the temple steps through the court of the Gentiles, through the court of the women, the court of the men, approaching the altar, seeing the gospel portrayed then in shed blood, dismembered animals, the high priest standing in for him, a figure of Christ, moving in and out of the spaces of the temple. That's the sense of the temple precincts. Hearing the sounds of prayer, all the sounds that you would hear in the temple. We painted this picture when we commenced the Psalms. You'd have competing sounds of prayer from individuals and groups, the music of choirs, and then the music of individuals as they stood there and sang psalms of praise, some psalms of lament, a regular cacophony, but all beautiful in its chorus to God. Then sitting at the foot of the altar, eating a portion, we saw how meals were eaten in front of the altar by the Levites, those you shared then with your congregants in sacrifices of praise. You would share a meal with a priest and his family. After a while, after a lifetime of doing these things, pretty soon life in the your perspective changes, doesn't it? Your perspective changes as you learn about God and dwell with him in the sanctuary. Life in the sanctuary creates a matrix of redemptive perspective, a dynamic, a synergy that opens up a picture of the whole of God's purpose. That's the sense here of being in God's sanctuary. Don't pass over that too quickly. Meditate on that. Ponder that for a while. You need to do this. You need to do this as a believer. Indeed, if you are going to know God, you have to spend time in his sanctuary. And here it's a figure. Now, for us, of course, a type and a picture, isn't it? And then, once that transformation begins to take place, when you are lifted up to that satellite perspective on the plate tectonics of redemptive history, you not only see the destiny of the faithless, but you see your destiny too, more importantly. You see your destiny, the destiny of the faithful. Several things he mentions in that regard. First of all, verse 23. Very intimate and personal. Another reason I love this psalm, it kind of opens up the door to seeing the personal nature of your relationship with God. He says, "Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand." Like a child. Asaph skillfully weaves these two pronouns together. I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. There's a mutuality here in this verse that shows a closeness, I submit to you, that is only found in biblical faith, too. You won't find this kind of intimate personal relationship in Islam or Buddhism or Hinduism. Life with the eternal God in this kind of personal, intimate relationship is found only in biblical Christianity. I submit to you. Secondly, verse 24, he says, "You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will receive me to glory." That is, I am brought infallibly to you in my earthly pilgrimage. I am brought infallibly to you in my earthly pilgrimage. Very personal again. That's the sense of godly counsel that leads a person step by step to God's presence and glory. Google Maps has nothing of God's guidance, does it? His is infallible. This is also a corollary of the perseverance of the saints. We, as Reformed Christians, trumpet the fact that, you know, once God brings you to life in him, he will infallibly bring you to his eternal home. Thirdly, then, verse 25. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. That is, Yahweh is the greatest good of my existence. Yahweh is the greatest good of my existence. Philosophers use this as a buzzword. Famous question in philosophy, what is the greatest good? Socrates asked this, went around asking people and then would dialogue with them. What is the greatest good? Opened up treasure troves of knowledge and wisdom for him, and still does for us. What is the greatest good? Asaph exclaims, Yahweh is the greatest good of my existence. He knows it is God himself. And so it is for us too. both heaven and earth, right? What I have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. Once again, this truth unveiled and known personally and embraced by Asaph in the precincts of the temple as he worships. And so it is for us too. Do you know this is a proof text for the first question of the Shorter Catechism? Can you see why? What is the chief end of man? Let's hear it in one voice. What is the chief end of man? To glorify God and enjoy him forever. Very, very wise on the divine's part to use this verse, right? They understood the nature of this verse. Enjoying God forever. Indeed, whom have I in heaven? And when you come to the end of the day, what else is there? Huh? What else is there but God and enjoying others even through your life in God? Yes. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there's nothing on earth that I... That's perspective. That's the perspective that we should have, that we should bring to all of our relationships as well. And then fourthly, verse 26. My flesh and my heart fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. This is humility, isn't it? In contrast to the arrogance, overweening pride of the wicked. A good test, wicked or righteous? Are you proud or humble? Fourthly, Asaph declares, I am weak, but thou art strong. Mm-hmm. The words of the old hymn, Just a Closer Walk with Thee, really does aptly describe the upshot of this verse. We're mortal. Humility in the presence of omnipotence demands that we should confess this. Implicit here is the promise that this strong creator and redeemer sustains the heart, and he does so into eternity. That's the portion that he speaks of here. We saw it in our reading of the law. Portion means inheritance. You are my inheritance, O living God, my creator. This is the portion of the saints. So Asaph then concludes with a classic wisdom contrast. The wicked, Dr. Faustus and his ilk, right? But for me, that is the righteous. And so this psalm ends as it has begun. That is telling of all God's works. That is that he is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. Indeed, he has been good to Asaph. He has opened his doors of understanding in his mind and his heart, has he not? Drawn him to himself, caused him to love him. Indeed, he has been good to those who are pure in heart. Well, that was all well and good for Asaph and Israel, right, in their day. But we don't have a temple anymore, do we? We don't have temple precincts. Too bad for us. Au contraire. We now dwell in places the Old Testament saint could only dream of, I submit to you. All of this is more available to us than even for them. The temple was only a shadow and a type of things to come. The author of Hebrews blows the doors off the temple, if you will, and says, we now dwell in a heavenly temple with the risen Christ. He says, therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus, that same word, the idea of holy places is the sanctuary, the temple precincts. We now enter those temple precincts in heaven through the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain, that is through his flesh. And since we have a great high priest over the house of God, let us draw near. The sense in which Asaph has drawn near once he reaches those temple precincts. We now do this in the living Christ who has opened that way for us. Let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience. We leave that wickedness at the blood of the altar, sprinkled clean from an evil conscience. No more wickedness, no more envy of wicked men, from an evil conscience, and our bodies washed with pure water, he says. So, talk about perspective. This is perspective. You have the satellite view of redemption, if you will. You are able to place this isolated volcano of wickedness that you see over here, or that individual earthquake of evil over there, or that single tsunami of Satan over there. all of which drive lost men to consternation and envy, but you are able to place it into the larger picture of God's own plate tectonics of redemption, if you will. Now, this doesn't mean inactivity. This doesn't mean we don't do things. We are encouraged to go out then and do good. You are to be active. You're awake. You are to live and bring the gospel to bear in your world with conscience. Do good. All the while, not envying, not selling your soul as a Faustus, as a modern-day Faustus, to the devil for a few years of gruel. By dwelling in his presence. We stay in his presence. How do we stay in his presence now? We don't have the temple precincts to wander, do we? We stay in his presence by staying in the text, staying in your Bible. These are marks, too. Check yourself. If you're not doing these, then you're not practicing presence, are you? Practicing the presence of God. Stay in the text. Stay in prayer. Be in worship. Be in fellowship with God's people. Be in self-conscious work of the kingdom, too. Labor. And by doing this, you create this matrix of redemptive perspective, not a matrix of death. Take the red pill. Wake up. Stay in the text, stay in prayer, stay in worship, stay in fellowship, in self-conscious work of the kingdom, and you dwell then in God's sanctuary. You have an understanding then of God's whole working, and you're better able to act too by that measure. And you have the larger picture of his own label with which to soothe your soul. So, do not be grieved, envious, or caused to stumble by wicked men. Do good with the understanding that you indeed have no one in heaven but Christ, with no higher desire than him either. Well, let us now come then to that place where we find Christ in the body and blood, in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.